Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 19th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning is Paul Olson. Today's session number is 2006 and is titled Great Stories We Need to Know, Radical Vision, the Bible, and African American Stories. Let's listen in.
In listing some of the radical things that Jesus said.
And we don't have to look at the Bible, just we'll remember probably most of them, and if you don't, I can help too. And then spin out of that into an African American sociologist. I think what I got mixed up with is that one of my favorite sociologists is a guy named Peter Berger, who wrote a book called The Precarious Vision, and deals with a lot of these same things. But this guy, Leroy Bennett, is not Swedish, he is African American. And in his book called The Negro Mood, in his first publication, later changed to The Black Mood, I've got that there. He makes this observation: the social system as organized is incapable of solving through normal channels the urgent problem presented to it by history. And our job will be in this hour that we are going to solve all of the social problems. And when we go, we can just hype, no more sessions, nothing else is needed, we'll be done. Our real goal will be to listen to what African American poets and writers say about these urgent problems, and maybe suggest we can some ways to look at this. And I also thought that this whole notion here, the social system, is a very big concept, of course, and that maybe together in this hour we can look at just two institutions where we probably have some power: the church and the schools. And we'll see how that unfolds as we go. So, with all that in mind, let's just start. Throw out, and I'll be your recording secretary, as I said, as many of the radical statements that Jesus said as you can think of.
Give me your right hand.
Pardon me?
Right hand causes you to sin, cut it off.
And there isn't a one of us probably who didn't have that right hand in a cookie jar at some point in your life, and now it's gone. Pretty radical stuff. Good.
Give away.
Also, sell, give away. All to the rich man, right?
Give to the poor.
And give to the poor. All you have. I read that phrase frequently in my life, and one of the things I love to do is get on the Mississippi River with my boat. Jesus couldn't have been. He couldn't have been my boat. Could he? All I have, not my boat. Yes.
I don't know how it was said, but if you suffer now, you'll be rewarded in heaven. Something like that.
Yeah. We'll just put it that way. Yeah.
This may be part of the suffering one, but take up your cross. Pretty rad.
Yeah.
Turn the other cheek.
Wow. Does everybody remember the context of that, turn the other cheek? It doesn't look the other way, is it? Remember?
It's enemy strikes here.
Yeah.
It's here. Turn the other cheek.
The other one too now. I just thought of this, it just flashed across my mind of thinking of this. Desmond Tutu's book, In the Bookstore, No Future Without Forgiveness, is absolutely an unbelievable story of grace and forgiveness and existential acknowledgement of my life, to get it fancy, but just grace and forgiveness, boy, run over there and get it, or borrow mine or something, but turn the other cheek. Good, keep going.
The last should be first.
The last or first?
Easier for a camel to go through needle's eye than a rich man to go through heaven.
I'm just going to shorten these so we can remember them. The camel and the rich man's story.
Love one another.
That's pretty radical.
Paul, it's specific but love your enemies.
Yep. Really bad.
And you call the religious leaders you group of vipers.
Pastor Rody, no. Brood of vipers. Pastors.
The religious establishment is what he's after, of course.
Good.
Forgive 70 times 7?
Yeah. Unlimited forgiveness. Infinity. Judge not.
You without sin, throw the first stone.
Yeah, great story. You without sin. We're all adulterers. We're all murderers. Radical stuff. None of us sees us, ourselves that way. Well, then we'll run back to this. so that we can take comfort in the fact that that looking at radicalism isn't such a... It's scary. But it's pretty true to the Gospels. The social system as organized is incapable of solving through normal channels the urgent problem presented to it by history. And what history has presented us with, and whether we have played a role in that or not, it doesn't matter. History has presented us with inequality in the races. It has presented us with inequality in gender. We know all the things that have been going on at Holden. We heard Michael's wonderful sermon last night about the walls that have been built up. And we didn't build them, perhaps, but history has passed that on to us. And with those walls in place, as a society is organized, we're incapable of solving those urgent problems. So we look at Jesus and say, we have to do all this stuff, and we say, well, come on, he didn't mean it quite that way, and I'm joking about sell my boat, but when we apply it to ourselves personally, we're going to find some rationalization to figure this thing out, and we're going to interpret that some way that fits what we do, because we solve things, probably, through those normal channels of how we think and how we perceive the world. I have this silly little diagram up here to illustrate something that comes from a Native American prophet, and the prophet is named Smahala, and he's part of the Nez Perce tribe out here in the West Coast. I mean, he was. And this prophet speaks to us about something that my diagram perhaps illustrates. We all see truth as we look out there, and we don't want to deny that, and I don't think Lerone Bennett denies that either. But what we see by this little diagram isn't the only truth. And there are other ways to live, to see things, other ways to perceive the world. Think how shocking Jesus is with all of their, pick any one of those statements, when the people he's speaking to see the world this way through their tunnel vision, and Jesus presents another truth, truth that's all around us. Well, here's one about the structure of society, and it's a whole, well, let you tell us what this means. Smahala speaks from the Nez Perce tribe, he's the prophet. My young men shall never work. Men who work cannot dream, and wisdom comes in dreams. You ask me to plow the ground. Shall I take a knife and tear my mother's breast? And then when I die, she will not take me to her bosom to rest. You ask me to dig for stone. Shall I dig under her skin for bones? And then when I die, I cannot enter her body to be born again. You ask me to cut grass and make hay and sell it and be rich like white men. How dare I cut my mother's hair? It is a bad law, and my people cannot obey it. I want my people to stay with me here. All the dead men will come to life again. We must wait here in the house of our fathers and be ready to meet them in the body of our mother. What do you make of that?
Mother.
Pardon me?
We have to be respectful of Mother Earth.
For sure. Mother Earth. I can't cut her hair. I can't dig up her bones. I can't dig into her, I can't mine. They can't. And yet, so, that's great. How else would we assess what he says about his values and his view of life? My men shall never work. Every one of us learned a long time ago a phrase for the American ideology about work. Mm-hmm. What is it? That's a bad question because it pins
all
it down so
no
much.
Play.
Huh?
All work and no play.
All work and no play. We're going to have some kind of balance with it, for sure. And in 1607, when James Smith talks about the settling of Jamestown, he said to his folks, what? If you don't work, you don't eat. We're going to establish that. Sociologists give it the phrase, the Protestant
work
ethic. We value that. I can't tell you how many students come to me with a paper that's 16 pages long, and it gets a grade that they don't like, and they say, but I work so hard on it. That the end in itself is the work, not the quality of that, or not the kind of insights that the paper should offer. But I work so hard, and that should be rewarded. And we have that, it's built into us, and now all of a sudden Samahala comes along and says, my men shall never work. There ought to be one little clue in here for the women. They can. They can gather, and they can hunt, and, but we'll put that aside for a moment, though that is part of that too. My men shall never work, and why not? Do you remember it?
Because it would take away from their dreaming.
Yeah, men who work cannot dream. What do we call those kids when, if you're a teacher and there are little kids and they dream?
Daydreamers.
Come on, get to work. You're daydreaming again, Polly. My name's Paul. I heard that. You're daydreaming. My men shall never work. For men who work cannot dream, and wisdom lies in dreams. The point is, isn't it? There's a whole other value about what we're going to pay attention to. We pay attention to work. And so, you list them. What are some of the truth, the social values that we have? The big ones. You can be general, because we're going to get specific in a moment with the poetry. Some of the general values of American society that our normal channels in this social system have. What are some of our values?
Material values.
Sure. So, I'll just symbolize that. That's one of them for sure.
Everyone for themselves.
What?
Everyone for themselves.
Sure. Self, I'll put it this way, versus community. It's a whole other value.
Moral values.
And our moral values, English literature, more so than American literature, raises the whole question about values of the difference between manners and morals. And we've all been, that's the 19th century stuff out of England, but we've all been pushed to that point, behave. Dress right. Someone once told me, when you go out and apply for your house loan, be sure you wear your wingtip shoes and your suit. Never mind that I'm honest and that I work hard and that I got a regular income. Dress right, have the proper manners. There's more to that than getting a loan from a bank, though. Good, our morals. And so what are some things that are traditionally immoral that Jesus might take a second look at? You already gave one of these examples up here. I wrote it. Maybe it isn't. Sonia gave it.
Sex.
Cast the first stone?
No, that's the one you made.
What?
I said sex.
Yeah. We have a whole lot of attitudes about sex. Read William Steiner and Sophie's Choice and how America pays. And that's about the Holocaust and his complaint. I'm paraphrasing the theme of the book. Throughout America, we have paid much more attention to the little boy masturbating behind a bedroom door than we did during World War II to 900 Jews a day being burned at Auschwitz. And our manners and our morals and roles of good. Well, there are other truths, and Jesus has made that clear for us, and now the system that Lerone Bennett points to makes it true to us as well. One more reference that and this is in our library. I think they're out in the bookstore, but how many people have read The Color Purple by Alice Walker? Okay, lots of you. We're not going to get into a discussion of that because we can't share that in common. But one of the things that's significant about that book, I think, is that the only relationships that work in that book are unconventional. The most loving family has two men and one woman part of the time, and then one of them gets sent to jail and then or leaves, and then another woman comes in, and then for a while it's two women and one man. They are not, well, they are. In fact, they are sexually involved too. The book doesn't get into that. But the key for sure is that the unconventional relationships in that book are all the ones that work. They're the ones that, and by work I mean the most loving. The least loving relationships are in traditional marriage. Husband and wife, it's physically abusive, sexually abusive, emotionally, verbally, in every way we can see. Okay, my question for you guys now will be, what do we have to do to change the situation that would make a poet write the stuff I'm going to read to you? Writers write, short story writers, novelists, autobiography, poetry. We write out of our experiences. What do we need to do in our structure to change? And some of these are pretty simple. And the first one is simply about an artist. And there are two things that we need to know about this one, I guess, is that the poet is talking about that God is good and that God could explain these things if I asked him. But there's one thing he just, I don't think, could ever explain. And there's an allusion here to Sisyphus, and that's the guy in Greek mythology, what, that rolls a rock up the hill and it comes back down again, and he's punished eternally to roll the rock up, and it rolls back down, and it rolls back up. Okay, that's all you need to know, I think. I doubt not God is good, well-meaning, kind, and did he stoop to quibble, could tell me why the little buried mole continues blind, why flesh that mirrors him must someday die, and make plain the reason tortured Tantalus is baited by the fickle fruit, declare if merely brute caprice dooms Sisyphus to struggle up a never-ending stair, he can explain all these things. Inscrutable his ways are, and immune to catechism by a mind too strewn with petty cares to slightly understand what awful brain, meaning full of awe, awful brain compels his awful hand. Yet, do I marvel at this curious thing, to make a poet black and bid him sing? What is that poet asking about? If we write from our own experiences, I'm curious, how do you make a poet black and then ask him to, can you answer that, God? And so what do poets write about then, historically? What do we know from way back to modern? And you can just guess, you don't have to have read one black poet. What do you think if we write out our experience they're gonna write about?
Oppression.
Can we get concrete?
Slavery.
Huh?
Slavery.
Slavery.
Or brutality.
Brutality.
Injustice.
Injustice.
Discrimination.
Discrimination. Drinking from this, and then the poet finds the images for that. I'm not gonna sing about I walked to this water fountain and you walked to that one. I'm not gonna sing about the guy that said you can't stay here tonight. I'm not gonna sing about sorry folks, or sorry kids, this party's for white folks. I'm not gonna sing about would you sit in the back of the schoolroom while the white kids line up alphabetically. I'm thinking of a novel by Langston Hughes. Well, we'll go further and more. A wonderful poem that you'll get clearly by Gwendolyn Brooks. She is the first black poet to win the Pulitzer Prize, and she is the poet laureate of Illinois. I think if we were to read, and this is an interesting, I'm talking with Jeff, he's an high school English teacher. Did you study black literature in college? And I didn't. I didn't know that Gwendolyn Brooks was probably as good a poet as Robert Frost. But that was part of my education. I mean, she was not a part of my education. And that's racism in the school systems, of course. And we'll come to that then eventually out of the social system as organized. And then how do we reorganize the schools? How do we reorganize the churches? And we'll address that, you will, in a moment. Well, anyway, this poem is written in the fall of 1957, and it's called The Chicago Defender, that's the name of a newspaper, sends a man to Little Rock. And the plot of this poem is they've sent somebody down to Little Rock to find out who in the world could set a bomb off that would blow up four little kids. How can anybody be so so cruel? And that's not what happened in Little Rock. In Little Rock is the integration of the school. They want to find out about segregation at any point.
just some things to so when you get to them, she's going to talk about, the poet is, about how normal things are there. And the last line is, the last three lines, I saw a bleeding brownish boy, the reporter does, and the lariat lynch wish I deplored. It's a hard line to follow, but until we follow up with this, the loveliest lynchy was our Lord. I think it has to do with the death of innocence, and that Jesus clearly was innocent and they lynched him. And these kids are innocent, and so that's a connection to know. But just pay attention, I guess, to all the simple things that go on in life and how normal these people are. In Little Rock, the people bear babes and comb and part their hair and watch the want ads, put repair to roof and latch, while wheat toast burns, a woman waters multi-ferns. Time upholds or overturns the many tight and small concerns. In Little Rock, the people sing Sunday hymns like anything through Sunday pomp and polishing. And after testament and tunes, some soften Sunday afternoons with lemon tea and Lorna Doones. I forecast and I believe, come Christmas, Little Rock will cleave to Christmas tree and trifle, weave from laugh and tinsel texture fast. And Little Rock is baseball, barcarolle, that hotness in July, the uniformed figures raw and implacable and not intellectual, battling the hotness or clawing the suffering dust, the open-air concert on the special twilight green, when Beethoven is brutal or whispers to ladylike air, blanket sitters are solemn as Johann troubles to lean to tell them what to mean. There is love, too, in Little Rock. Soft women softly opening themselves in kindness, or pitying one's blindness, awaiting one's pleasure in azure glory with anguished rose at the root. To wash away old semi-discomfitures, they reteach purple and unsullen blue, the wispy soils go, and uncertain half-havings have they clarified to sures. Simply, people ask questions, don't quite get the answers. It's all simple folk, right? In Little Rock, they know not answering the telephone is a way of rejecting life. That it is our business to be bothered, is our business to cherish bores or boredom, be polite to lies and love and many-faceted fuzziness. I scratch my head to massage the hate I had. I blink, and by the way, the Chicago Defender is a black newspaper, so the reporter is black. So when he scratched my head, massaged the hate I had, I blink across my prim and pencil pad, the saga I was sent for is not done. Because there is a puzzle in this town. The biggest news I do not dare telegraph to the editor's chair. They are like people everywhere. The angry editor would reply in 100 harryings of why? And true, they are hurling spittle, rock, garbage, and fruit in Little Rock. And I saw a coiling storm arrive on bright Madonnas, and a sigh of men harassing brownish girls, the bows and barrettes and the curls and braids declined away from joy. How old are those little girls? I mean, they're kids. They wear bows and barrettes, and I'll run that line again. And true, they are hurling spittle, rock, garbage, and fruit in Little Rock. And I saw a coiling storm arrive on bright Madonnas, and a sigh of men harassing brownish girls, the bows and barrettes and the curls and braids declined away from joy. I saw a bleeding brownish boy. The lariat wish I deplored, the loveliest lynchy was our Lord. I'll erase this. And as we go, we'll pay attention to the poets and to our own observations about it. What has to change? Here's our phrase. The social system, as organized, is incapable of solving through normal channels the urgent problem presented to it by history. Turn the other cheek.
Doesn't it have to start at the individual?
Individual responsibility.
The idea that all that hatred and all the fruit. preach from here or whatever is normal. Like, this whole poem was about how everything was like everywhere else, but then he went on to specify that all this stuff was for them.
Good.
One of the things that perpetuated South African apartheid is that people saw this as normal. My life is normal. I have my TV, I have my telephone, I go to work. And it's normal to see this bus come in from 50 miles away with the workers for the day. It's normal to see that all of the cleaning positions and the janitorial positions and the street sweepers positions are all black. It's normal. And good point. So we see normal as different. More.
I think the perception that evil is something that's separate and not rooted in what's normal, what's everyday, and what we all participate in.
Real evil, says William Styron in Sophie's Choice, is mundane, boring. The kind of evil that we think is evil, that's sensationalized in the movies, is romantic and sensationalized. But, and he's talking about the Holocaust, but he talks about the real evil takes place when four engineers sit down together and say, you know, if we made the walls of this furnace 4 inches thicker, it could withstand heat up to 950 degrees instead of 650 degrees, and bodies would burn. And they got it all calculated, how much faster they would burn, and how many more people they can push through the crematoriums per day. Mundane and boring, and it's a great phrase, redefine evil. This one doesn't, it'll seem to be not relevant, and maybe it isn't. Maybe I'm just reading because this is a great poem. this one is called The Mother. It's also by Gwendolyn Brooks, and it's about abortion. And two lines to anticipate. One of them is, it'll be obvious that the powerful images that she chooses to talk about abortion, and a line to just be sure that you catch is, believe, you know, this is a woman who has had this abortion and now she's reflecting on it, and she says, believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. And the finality of all of our acts that are preceded by ambiguity and uncertainty, but finally you can't half abort. And most of our decisions you can't just do halfway. And so then the line, believe that even in my deliberateness, that's the act finally, I was not deliberate. And this is the stage of living in confusion and mystery and wonder. And but I'm gonna ask the question, you do whatever you want, but I'm also gonna ask the question, why does she get this abortion, do you think? I mean, we don't know. But you speculate, and then we'll go to the social system as organized, is incapable of solving through normal channels, and think of the national debate on abortion. Okay, here it is. This is a... Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulps with a little or no hair. The singers and workers that never handled the air. You'll never neglect or beat them, or silence or buy with the sweet. You'll never wind up the sucking thumb or scuttle off ghosts that come. You'll never leave them controlling your luscious sigh in return for a snack of them with a gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind the voices of my dim killed children. I have contracted. I have eased my dim dears at the breasts they could never suck. I have said, sweets, if I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your unfinished reach, if I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted or lovely loves, your tumults, your marriages, your aches, your deaths, if I poisoned the beginnings of your breaths, believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. But why should I whine? Whine that the crime was other than mine, since anyhow you are dead. Or rather, or instead, you were not made. Too, I'm afraid, is faulty. What shall I say? How is the truth to be said?
You were born, you lived, you died. It's just that you never giggled or planned or cried. Believe me, I loved you. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly. And I loved you all. Any images strike out at you? Abortions will not let you forget. Flippant, glib, easy decision. I used to have a one-man play traveled all around the United States with, and it was the whole play was the language of poetry, and this poem was in it. And I would just it was called The Pilgrimage of the Poets. We just moved through the human experiences of life, and this is one of those human experiences. And after I did them at colleges and different places, but at one college, a woman came at our own college, a woman that I knew came up, and I knew what her stand was on abortion, came up to me and said, "Can you get me a copy of that poem? That is exactly where I am on abortion." 5 minutes later, another woman came up, completely opposite view on abortion. "Can you get me a copy of that poem? That is exactly where I am on abortion." So there, that says something about ambiguity and uncertainty, but our system is as organized and capable of solving through. What made her get this abortion? We don't know. So your answer, I don't think.
She was raped.
What?
Raped.
Might have been. She was raped.
She spoke as though it wasn't her first abortion.
What?
Excuse me.
Okay.
She spoke as though it wasn't her first abortion.
I loved you. I loved you all.
Mm-hmm. Some very hard circumstances.
Yeah, circumstances. I can't keep this kid. I can't afford it. Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun, one of the wonderful themes flowing through that play, is the woman, the wife in the house, has decided to have an abortion because they have no room to put this baby in their apartment that is already shared. I mean, the bathroom is down the hall, shared by four other families, and there's three kids in this. No room. And her mother says to her, "I thought we had talked about saving lives instead of killing it." It's an issue. What are the circumstances? What are the urgent problems presented by history? Well,
I suppose that in this day and age, they think that there are contraceptive methods, and so then blaming the person, the woman, for being careless, you know, putting all the responsibility on her part.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And which is very unjust, but.
It's, of course, the woman's job not to get pregnant.
It'd be interesting to contrast a discussion with women only, you really might be leading it, as opposed to just having the same discussion with the men only. How would that be different?
With regard to responsibility
abortion.
And no abortion, but in the
dimension. Responsibility and everything that goes along with abortion.
Yeah.
Morality.
Yeah.
Reality.
And the logistics of caring for a child. And,
exactly.
And, yeah, good point. Good point. Yes.
Could it be also that maybe she doesn't want to bring her child into this world if it's been so hard on her, knowing, especially like, I don't know if it ever said if she's black or anything, but just like if, you know, people were so judgmental and oppressive towards her, she doesn't want a child to have to live through that.
Yeah. If anybody's read Toni Morrison's book, Beloved, the main part of that story is that the main character, the hero, the protagonist of the story, has escaped from slavery, has four kids, and she sees coming down the road, as she looks out the window, her former slave master, and she takes her children out of the woodshed and kills them. Rather than let them endure slavery, she'll kill them. She doesn't succeed, she tries to kill them. She kills one. That's Beloved, and that's the ghost that occupies her house.
That's the bluest eye, isn't it?
Beloved.
Oh.
Bluest Eye is also by Toni Morrison, and it's a good book, too. Good. Well, anything that we heard from Jesus about the radical look at how, I mean, again, consider how America is trying to deal with this problem and how split we are, and it's always a plank for a politician. Jesus said, you just heard from a woman. And these two women in my audience one day came, I want that copy. I'm making a connection in my mind anyway about how Jesus looks at this.
Who's going to throw the first stone?
Who's going to throw the first stone? Judge not. How does this happen? And then, so through our normal channels, can we solve I don't know where I am on this issue politically. It's because, and I don't know, probably because that poem has taught me not to know. Paul.
Well, the thing that is so powerful in both of the last poems is the way they caught the nuances of human experience. And not just to see normal as different, but to see the humanness. And the social systems don't see human beings. They see slogans or positions, that was very nuanced.
Yeah. That's a wonderful phrase that systems don't see, and we don't either, as because we see through the eyes of most of us do, through the eyes of the system, and our system sees the truth, ignoring the nuances or the complexity of human experience.
I said cut your hand off, but in that same phrase, Jesus says pluck out your eye.
Yeah.
If you don't see.
Yep. Good. Okay, we'll go with a couple others. Here's one that's easy to see. Fun little poem, very short. And your answers to what do we have to change will be obvious, but this is writing out of the black experience. Once riding in old Baltimore, heart-filled, head-filled with glee, I saw a Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. Now I was 8 and very small, and he was no whit bigger. So I smiled, but he poked out his tongue and he called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until December, and of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember. Ooh. Whew, huh? Any responses?
We're responsible for our actions.
Yeah.
We don't know how they affect other people.
And one negative word will overpower all.
Yeah. I saw all. Good.
I think of sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you. But that's not true.
No.
Why?
No. If you were at the forum, I guess it was Monday night, wasn't it? When was the forum about? And we got into the discussion of the word queer, and how difficult it was for different people to handle that in different ways. And the complexity of, we can get into that if you want to, but the complexity of language carries great power. Good point. Here is, Frederick Douglass in the slave narrative. This affects all of us, believers, who hang out at Holden Village. Frederick Douglass, the narrative of Frederick Douglass is his story of escape from slavery and his life after that. And in his appendix, this is Douglass speaking in 1845, between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference, so wide that to receive the one as good, pure, and holy is of necessity to reject the other as bad, corrupt, and wicked. What was the mainline support for slavery in the 19th century? The church. What was the mainline support for apartheid in South Africa? The church. So when John DiGucci, a white guy of the Anglican Church, writes his book, The Church's Struggle in South Africa, he is indeed on the periphery. He is indeed the radical, talking about the church's struggle that we have to change. Well, Douglass has a few other things to say. Dark and terrible as is this picture, I hold it to be strictly true of the overwhelming mass of professed Christians in America. They strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Could anything be more true of our churches? That's his first metaphor. Get that gnat out of here. I'll eat this. Okay, you get the point. they would be shocked at the proposition of fellowshipping a sheep stealer. I mean, we can't let a sheep stealer be a part of our congregation. And at the same time, they hug to their communion a man stealer and brand me with being an infidel if I find fault with them for it. The man stealer is, of course, the slave owner, the woman stealer too, but this is the 19th century. They attend with, I'll skip that. They are always ready to sacrifice, but seldom to show mercy. They are they who are represented as professing to love God, whom they have not seen, whilst they hate their brother, whom they have seen. Well, here are some pretty radical poems that'll shake your boots. And I don't do this to sensationalize this, and you'll get the point, I think. Even in art, and as somebody that pays attention to literature their whole professional life, as I have, and then some others out there too, we have had for us defined this is what good art is. And the black poets of the 60s took this vision of truth, this is what good art is, and turned it completely upside down. And I'll read a poem to you that Samuel Johnson, one of the great literary critics of the 17th century, or 18th century, would never say, that's not even a poem. But you'll get the point. I wasn't going to read this, and I just thought of it now, so I have to find it. But I found it. 1968, the Paris peace talks in Vietnam, do you remember what they were about? Does anybody remember anything peculiar about those Paris peace talks?
The shape of the table.
Yeah. That was the 6 months to decide the shape of the table. And where, I mean, and duh, they finally decided on a round one. You know, King Arthur could have told them 3,000 or 2,000 years. Okay, well, here's a poem. And I read it to suggest to English teachers and to me, that's not a poem. But this is how Donnell Lee, the African-American poet and scholar at the University of Chicago, would read this. I've heard him read it. This is his poem called Communication in Whitey. Dust to click, 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 dust to dust to dust to dust to dust to dust to all, dust to all. The Paris Peace Talks, 1968. What does the social system as organized? And so we've had turned upside down for us. Donnell Lee's a scholar. He knows that's not a great poem. But what have we just experienced?
Confusion.
Huh? Confusion. In a good poem, the language is?
None.
Stupid. Paris Peace Talks, 1968. The language is? None. Stupid. None about the war. Let's get the tape in 6 months.
Must be in code.
What?
Must be in code.
Yeah, it's got to be in code. Somebody decode this.
This is the phrase, death to all, comes through here. Did I just project
it? No, it came. Death to all. Death to, death to, death to, death to.
That's all that it said in the midst of the nonsense.
Very good. In the midst of all this nonsense, in this chaos, in this absurdity, death to all. I once had students look up how many people, I don't remember the number now, but how many people were killed during those 6 months. And while we're... Well, the point in looking at that, and the point from Don L. Lee is, we understand poetry to be one thing. We understand, how do we look at life? How do we have these, we still have it up here. Our morals, our values, what are they? And the poet addresses that any way he can. And especially if we think that art is not only about experience, but is experience, we just experienced confusion. What's this? What's this? The very same thing that Don L. Lee would ask us to say about those talks. What's this? What's this? I don't get it. So the poem is not just about, does that make sense to you? It's not about the Paris Peace Talks. It makes us experience what those Paris Peace Talks are and what the absurdity of war is. And, well, they get better, they get more radical. This one will scare you. Didn't mean the first time I read it. Poor little white kid from northern Minnesota. Don L. Lee again. This is how he reads it. Change! Like if you were a match, I would light you into something beautiful. Change, change, for the better, into a real, real together thing. Change from a make-believe nothing on cornmeal and water. Change. Change from the last drop to the first. Maxwell House did. Change. Change was a programmer for IBM. Thought him was a brown computer. Change. Color to something written on southern outhouses. Change. Greyhound did. I mean, they got restrooms on buses. Change, 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 nigger. Saw a nigger hippie, him wanted to be different, changed. Saw a nigger liberal, him wanted to be different, changed. Saw a nigger conservative, him wanted to be different, changed. Niggers, don't you know niggers are different? Change. A double change. Nigger wanted a double zero in front of his name, a license to kill. Niggers are licensed to be killed. Change. A negro, something pigs eat. Change. I say change into a real black, righteous aim. Like, I don't play saxophone, but that don't mean I don't dig train. Change. Hear you coming, but your steps are too loud. Change. Even a lamppost changes, nigger. Change. Stop being an instant yes machine. Change. Niggers don't change, they just grow. That's a change, bigger and better. Niggers. Change into a necessary black self. Change like a gas meter gets higher. Change like a blues song talking about a righteous tomorrow. Change like a tax bill getting higher. Change like a good sister getting better. Change like knowing wood will burn. Change, know the real enemy. Change. Change, nigger. Nigger standing on the corner, thought him was cool. Him still standing there, it's winter, him cool. Change. Know the real enemy. Change. Him wanted to be a TV star. Him is. 10 o'clock news. Wanted, wanted. Nigger stole some lemon and lime popsicles. Thought them were diamonds. Change, nigger. Change. Know the real enemy. Change. Is you or is you ain't. Change. Now, now. Change. For the better. Change. Read a change. Live a change. Read a black poem. Change. Be the real people. Change. Black poems will change. Know the real enemy. Change. Know the real enemy. Change. Your enemy. Change. Know the real. Change. Know the real enemy, change, change. Know the real enemy, the real enemy, the real, real, real enemy. Change your the enemies, change your enemy, change your enemy. Know the real enemy, the world's enemy. Know them, know them. Real enemy, change your enemy, change your change, change, change your enemy, change, 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 change your change, change your mind, nigger. Same time that was written, a white guy wrote a book called The Student as Nigger. I mention that because there's a guy who's white and he calls all students niggers. What's that poem do to you? You heard it all. Just in your guts. That's where literary criticism starts. Change your mind. The very last thing, it's an exhortation. Change your mind, nigger.
Authority, you talk.
Conform to the white. Conform, the authority. Yes, ma'am.
You're not good the way you are.
You're not good the way you are.
You change the social system. You follow the social system.
Yeah, change. Don't follow the social system. This is what you're doing. You're expected to be a thief. Wanted to be a TV star. Him is. Thought there, you know, the popsicle thing. It's a joke. It's funny, but it's not funny. Where does he end up? On TV. Who ends up on TV? The black criminal. Think of all the things that we wrote that Jesus said. I don't want to blaspheme. Could Jesus have written that poem? Change your mind, nigger. Every black scholar I know would say that not only are black people, not only can black people be niggers, so can whites. Change your mind. See a different truth.
More reactions.
I heard several years ago that a nigger is anybody that lets somebody else identify.
I think there'd be a lot of black poets who would buy that definition. Nigger is anybody who lets somebody else define them. You're abusing. So how radical all this stuff is. I mean, it's not the kind of poems that we're used to. Here's one you're used to. Two roads diverged in the yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. It's a wonderful poem. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could, but it's pretty radical. I looked down one as far as I could and then took the other. is just as fair, perhaps, and having a better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. Oh, I saved the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. That's Robert Frost. Radical? Yeah. But he didn't take poetry and reinvent it. He took conventional poetry and gave us a radical concept. Take the road less traveled by.
He also expressed the deliberateness that's not deliberate in the Gwendolyn Brooks poem, I think. The thing you choose that doesn't let you go back.
Yeah, very good. Long I stood.
You said you took conventional poetry, but that's by those who define conventional, right?
Yeah, that's a great observation.
The guy from Chicago State.
John Ellie?
Yeah. You know, his language has centuries of roots in kind of rhythmic communication and bringing the truth right out in front and then backing your way to the subtleties, whereas those of us from European traditions are more used to working our way up to the point of building on the subtleties. And so I wouldn't call, except with her two thoughts maybe, but maybe not. A lot of that poetry on the international, seems pretty steeped in a cultural tradition. It's just different than those who define.
Yep.
It's just a different convention.
That's right. It's a different convention. So if we could put that word in here instead of truth, maybe that's the word we should have. Is this good poetry? Well, Samuel Johnson says no, but the African-American does. Says yes, this is. We're looking for different rhythms. We're looking for other things to turn things upside down. Here's one we've got a little bit that you'll enjoy, I think. This is about buying into the system so much that you've lost your sense of existential self. Now, those are fancy words that the poet would never use, and they talk much better than that. 299. But he was cool, or he even stopped for green lights, is the title. And this guy is so cool because he's bought into all, this guy's black, and he's bought into all the things that you're supposed to be if you're black. If you're African American, you're going to be proud of your heritage, and you'll hear it. But just note that. And this is how Don L. Lee reads that. Super cool, ultra black, a tan purple head, a beautiful shade. He had a double natural that would put the sisters to shame. His dashikis were tailor-made, and his beads were imported seashells from some black country he never heard of. He was triple hip. His tikis were hand-carved out of ivory and came express from the motherland. He would greet you in Swahili, say goodbye in Yoruba. Woo, Jim, he'd be so cool and intelligent. Cool is so cool. He was uncool, but other black dudes cool. Cool, ultra cool, was hot cool, bop cool, icebox cool. So cool, cold, cool. His wine didn't have to be cooled. Him was air-conditioned cool. Cuckoo, real cool, made me cool. Now, ain't that cool? Cuckoo's so cool, him nicknamed Refrigerator. Cuckoo's typical, real cool. So cool, he didn't know. After Detroit, Newark, Chicago, Watts, L.A., we had the hip. Cuckoo, super cool, real cool. But to be black is to be very hot. Wow, radical. And I never get uneasy in this. Here I am, this white kid, I mentioned that already, from northern Minnesota, Luther College, University of Minnesota, and I'm at the University of Oregon, and there's a black militant poet teaching a course. And the first poem he read was, I wasn't planning to read this, but it's my own sense of what Jesus told us that finally resolved me to be comfortable with this poem, because I sure wasn't comfortable. You won't be either the first time I heard it. just the other day, too.
Nigger!
Can you kill? Can you kill? Can a nigger kill? Can a nigger kill a honky? Can a nigger kill the man? Can you kill, nigger, huh? Nigger, can you kill? Do you know how to draw blood? Can you poison? Can you stab a Jew? Can you kill, huh, nigger? Can you kill? Can you run a Protestant down with your A68 Eldorado? That's all they're good for anyway. Can you kill? Can you piss on a blonde head? Can you cut it off? Can you kill? A nigger can die. We ain't got to prove we can die. We got to prove we can kill. They sent us to kill Japan and Africa. We policed Europe. Can you kill? Can you kill a white man? Can you kill the nigger in you? Can you make your nigger mind die? Can you kill your nigger mind and free your black hands to strangle? Can you kill? Can you kill? Can a nigger kill? Can you shoot straight and fire for good measure? Can you splatter their brains in the street? Can you kill them? Can you lure them to bed to kill them? We killed in Vietnam for them. We killed for the UN and NATO and CETO and US and everywhere for all the alphabet but B-L-A-C-K. Learn, can we learn to kill white for black? Learn to kill niggers? Learn to be black men? And they, well, there you are. And here's this 25-year-old white kid sitting there. Oh my gosh. Until I guess learn to kill the nigger. Here's another word for this, right here. These poets gave it. Kill the nigger. And here's, over here, I think, I mean, at least it resolved me to understand and to dig deep into this kind of poetry, is that Jesus is saying, kill the nigger in you. Turn the other cheek, oh, Jesus, that's too much. Sell all you have? No way. Kill the nigger. The student as nigger. Anybody who lets somebody else define him. Now here's, we'll go back to the beginning. Here's Leroy Bennett. The social system is organized as passed down by history. It's incapable of solving through normal channels the urgent problems presented us. So, over here we wrote individual responsibility. Part of what poetry does, and art, and tomorrow I'm doing some stuff with Zora Neale Hurston, is that they give us different languages to see things. That we speak, we look at the world through different metaphors. In Their Eyes Are Watching God is a great, beautiful metaphor by an ex-slave is telling her daughter, her granddaughter's being real sassy with her, and she scolding her grandmother and saying, come on, grandma, let me do this. And the final metaphor that the grandmother uses is she tells her her story about slavery. And I'll save that if you come back for tomorrow. But she tells her story about slavery and then says, put me down easy, Janie, because I'm a cracked plate. And the metaphors with which we speak are part of how we decide how we're defined. And the metaphors that are handed down to us are the things that help shape our self-definition, too.